This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, The Business Station, 6 o'clock on Monday, the 24th of September. I'm Melissa Idris. I'll be keeping you company all the way till 10 o'clock today. And here with me is Joyce Goh and Kusu Chuang.
Morning.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Happy Mid-Autumn Festival.
Thank you. Brilliant.
Did you catch the moon this morning when you went to
work?
It was
lovely.
It was not small.
No, it was very bright and lovely, very beautiful.
No, it wasn't small, not at all. But so I think harvest moon, so something to, you can look at it again tonight, Chuang.
Oh, yes, sir.
Yeah, just admire it a little bit.
Today is the real mid-autumn festival day.
Mm. Actual day, yes. Again, you can join our conversation anytime this morning. You can tweet us or WhatsApp us. Our Twitter handle is at BFM Radio. Or you can send your messages to 018-789-8899. Remember to mention your name so we can read it out on air. Now, let's take a quick look, guys, at what happened over the weekend. I found the first day of the PKR polls to be quite interesting to watch because chaos reigned over the first day. Apparently, there were some tensions over the faulty e-voting system. So PKR members had been, very proud of this new e-voting system. Apparently, it didn't work. It prompted 9 divisions in Kedah to suspend elections. And whatever results that came up from there was later considered invalid.
Okay, well, I think they're looking at the polls will resume on September 30th in Johor after this whole chaotic end on what happened in Kedah.
Yeah, there were some chairs also being used as weapons. I think some chair throwing happening. I'm not quite sure what's happening within the PKR polls, but as we've spoken a lot on the show, it's very, there are factions within PKR and the reason why it's important for us to look at it, to pay close attention to PKR elections is because this is the first component party within the Pakatan Harapan government that's going to go for elections. And if...
And the largest.
And the largest. And there's growing division within this party. So it's very important to pay attention to which camp, so-called camp, wins and what that means for a growing split within this party. And Moody's wrote it best, I thought. They wrote in a report, they said, if PKR sneezes, Pakatan Harapan catches a cold.
So true, though.
So true.
So absolutely true.
All right. So the other big story we were watching over the weekend was Dato' Lee Chong Wei. He has come out to say that he's been diagnosed with early stage nasal cancer, prompting everyone from the Deputy Prime Minister, Dato' Sri Dr. Wan Azizah, as well as the Youth Sports Minister, Syed Saddiq, to come out and wish on his good health, pray for his good health.
Yeah, he has been in Taiwan with his family, his wife, his son Kingston and Terrence since July. And he did said, you know, saying that he's going to return soon. And he thanked everyone for their concern and all that. I think they're going to, he'll need 2 months for recovery.
So anomalous, isn't it? For someone so well, healthy and so fit to get, you know. So just, it's anomalous. I can't figure it out.
Well, there we have the sports minister urging Malaysians to respect Dato' Lee's privacy during this time. So I guess, you know, when he's good and ready to give us updates on his health, perhaps he will. We'll find out more about how he's doing. Now, a quick look into the biggest news heading into the week. This week, we're going to have the UN General Assembly. US President Donald Trump will be taking the podium on Tuesday. I believe this is US time for the UN General Assembly. This is the second time he's going to be attending as president. But what is going to be interesting, guys, is that the next day, on Wednesday, US time, he will be for the first time chairing a Security Council meeting. So they have this rotating chair for the Security Council. It's going to be the first time Donald Trump's going to chair it. All eyes will be on what he has to say with North Korea, with Iran.
Well, you know, talking about things said by other people, I think it was Hunter S. Thompson that said you should never give car keys and whiskey to teenage boys because, you know what might happen. It's the same thing with Donald Trump. You put him in charge of a Security Council, you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, definitely. Good point. I think he tweeted something and said that, you know, I will chair the UN Security Council meeting on Iran next week!
Yeah, so remember last year when he called Kim Jong-un the Rocket Man. So this is going to be one of the most watched Security Council meetings ever. And we'll keep a close eye on that. And coming back home, the happening this week, of course, is the UPSR examinations. It started last Thursday with the Mandarin and Tamil papers and will continue today with Bahasa Malaysia, English, Maths and Science subjects all the way till Thursday. So after this, we're going to be taking a look at how we can help you manage your exam stress better, both parents and children. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. It's coming up to 11 minutes past 6 o'clock on Monday, the 24th of September. I'm Melissa Idris with Joyce Goh and Koo Soo Chuang. And our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 and our Twitter handle is at BFM Radio. If you have a 12-year-old child who has UPSR this week, we'd love to hear from you. How are you dealing with the stress and how is your child dealing with the stress? Who's got it worse? I think sometimes parents have more exam nerves than the child itself.
Certainly in my household, that's the case. My kids, they're like, exam. Easy peasy lemon squeezy, you know, after the exam is over.
But well, then at that age, you don't know the consequences of an exam just yet, right? You're like, oh, it's an exam. And I don't remember being very nervous for my UPS. Granted, that was many, many years ago.
I was a wreck, man.
Are you a wreck?
Oh. Yeah, standard 3, standard 4, like, oh my God, exams. Till today, I've got nightmares about exams. Till today.
Really?
Yeah. Not often, like once in a while. Blue moon.
Like the mid-autumn festival moon today. So Joyce, you have kids. Do you get nervous if your kids have to sit for exams?
They're still young, but I foresee myself being the stressed out one more than my kids, I think. Yeah, maybe the parents are a bit more, nervous and prepping them for it. But I think nowadays, kids are a lot more, I don't know, they're more in tune with what's happening. And then, you know, when it comes to exams, I guess...
Not all kids.
Yeah?
Let's just put it that way.
Because my eldest sat for an entrance exam just one time and he handled it really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. But I was quite nervous.
I think that... I wonder whether you get, progressively, as you get older, you get more worried about exams because you realize the consequences or the weight of what an exam means. At 12 years old, it's not like you're not going to progress onwards to secondary school, right? It's not like you're going to be held back.
And even more so if the expectations placed on your parents are huge, right? If you go to like a fee-paying school, for example, or if you've got like several siblings and you are supposed to be the smartest cookie, then the whole family's pressure is on you, you know?
So the sibling thing, are you expected to outdo your elder sibling?
Well, there's always comparisons, deliberate or otherwise. And I think that rivalry gets more and more pronounced as you get older in age.
Yeah, but I try. I know it's... for me, I consciously try not to compare. But indirectly, sometimes you tend to, But no, because by comparing, are you setting them up to... compete could be good, healthy competition. But sometimes I think that could create stress as well. Unnecessary stress. I believe that when it comes to exams, even for myself, my parents used to tell me, just do your best, Joyce. Like, give it your best. Because and then whatever results you get, then they won't judge. But if you don't give it your best, and then I can lecture. Like,
how do they know if you don't give it your best?
I think parents can tell,
The education ministry is, I guess, advising parents not to apply pressure or undue pressure on children sitting for UPSR exams. They're saying that straight A's should not top the list because there are many other aspects of a pupil's capability. And one of the things that the education ministry is saying is that perhaps, take breaks. So let your children take breaks through the study period, as opposed to just sitting in front of a book, force feeding them.
The case of my household, they're more, once in a while there's a school day interspersed between their breaks. there's school among the plethora of holidays and breaks that they have in my house.
So this doesn't quite work for you. Because I was thinking back, when I would take a break from studying, that would be the only time my mom paid attention to me. She'd be like, oh, why are you not studying? Why are you watching TV? And I'm saying,
really?
It's a break. No, no. I mean, she'd notice it is what I mean, right? So when you're studying, no one actually notices it. But when you're actually taking a break or you're watching TV, then that becomes the point, the focal point. So does it look like you're watching TV more than you're studying?
My kids have never... I should have outed them so badly, but...
but you know, I think taking a break helps. Just like working, it's proven that sometimes you take a break and you come back rejuvenated, or you come back recharged, and you're a lot more focused.
No, my kids should take a break from all their leisurely activities and study once in a while.
So what about parents, right? So how can parents, I guess, hold back on undue pressure on children? Because sometimes it's about the amount of expectation that we place on them that causes this pressure.
Yeah, well, you know, horses for courses. In my household, I think my wife is much more stressed out about my kids than I am.
Mm-hmm. Why is she worried?
No, because she's hands-on. She's very micro, and she knows, you know, whether the boy or the girl is doing more or less. And let's just say she's more stressed out than me, lah. But and let's just say they should be doing a lot more than what they're doing now. I mean, for you to be the exception is the break rather than norm, which is studying. My house is different.
The otherwise, other way
100%
around.
Different.
Other
black
way
and
around.
White. Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it's true. Sometimes it's good to monitor or like try and guide them. Sometimes I feel that you let them just let them be and see how they progress. Like for example, yesterday we were supposed to go to a friend's house for dinner. So I mentioned to our kids that, oh, you know, we're going to Uncle this house for dinner for Mooncake Festival. And then my eldest, oh, I got homework. And
my son will never say that. He'll like, why homework? Probably not. Don't care.
And after I'm like, oh, okay. And he actually brought out his stuff to do. But it's because, I don't know, is it because sometimes we just let them be?
Then what happens
sometimes
in my household,
they learn responsibility.
Sometimes, yeah.
If that happens in my house, I'm going to go and buy a number. 100%.
It's a lucky day for you. Tell us what you think if you have a child sitting for the UPSR exam this week. We'd love to hear from you. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. How are you and your kids managing the stress? Tell us. We'd love to hear from you. Up next is we're going to be looking at looking at courts in Hong Kong. Excuse me. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 622 right now. That was Arctic Monkeys with Baby, I'm Yours. I'm Melissa Idris with Joyce Goh and Kusu Chong here this morning. And we're turning our attention over to Hong Kong, where judges there have been attacked for recent rulings, especially in politically sensitive cases. So savage criticism has at times been directed to the courts by people who are unhappy with their judgments. I believe some of the judges have been subjected to abuse, even threats. But I guess now they're saying, well, actually, how much attention do you pay to the legal reasoning behind these judgments? The reason that the judges have made these decisions, because court judgments are made public in Hong Kong. You know, it's whether or not the public has taken the time to go and read through these these court judgments to understand the reasoning behind such rulings.
Yeah, it's a society thing, and I think it's very similar to the electoral system as well, where events of monumental and national importance are delivered to the public.
Mm-hmm.
But then we don't realise how they have been delivered to the public and the reasons behind it. I mean, I studied law, and I think till today I still don't understand at least 30 to 40% of, you know, judges' notes and
judges'
pronouncements.
Yeah, well, they're hundreds of pages long.
That's right,
some of them, and it's full of legal jargon. But I do know some judges are famous for beautifully written court judgments, right?
Lord Denning, for example, yeah. He was still a bit of a legend.
So now the contention is whether or not courts in Hong Kong should go on social media. So put the social judgments on social media. Or in fact, take it one step further and allow video recording in the courtroom.
I think Britain has done that, right? They've allowed filming in courts, but that's quite really full on, though. And whether or not, I mean, the question here is, should Hong Kong consider that? Because when you open that up, you open the floodgates to a lot of judgment as well from the public.
Yeah, it's the court of public opinion now within the court of law.
Well, I think that's okay. I mean, Parliament is televised by and large, right? Even in Malaysia, I think the issue is not really whether it's made public or how it's delivered on which platform. It is the simplification of the law which is more important, I think.
Ah, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, because it is so technical. It can be so deep, and the language used can be very archaic at times. And some of these judgments don't have to run into 300-400 pages, especially if the
simplifying the court judgments as opposed to keeping it lengthy and technical. Okay,
yeah, executive summaries, for example,
but don't you think that the pendulum will swing too far on the other side? Because how do you condense a court judgment of hundreds of pages long into 240 characters to fit a tweet?
Well, that's the whole point, right? That's why Twitter is so successful, because it just gives you the meat and potatoes, right? And that's exactly what is needed. People can be acquitted, for example, based on technicalities, based on court process not being followed. But some people don't realize that. And I think plaintiffs and defendants, lawyers, prosecutors, they understand that people can be acquitted or can be convicted based on such things. And it's not really the... In some ways, it's not really the merits or demerits of the case. It's how well the process... So there's a lot of nitty-gritty within the system that can be explained and must be explained more simply.
Yeah, it also depends on which court, right? Because I think I understand in Hong Kong, the Court of Final Appeal, they publish summaries of some judgments. So that helps to clarify key issues. And, you know, that comes... Sometimes it's better. It's more layman. I mean, not so technical, I guess. So it depends on which court as well the judgment comes
sometimes
from.
Sometimes I watch all these kind of thriller docu-series on Netflix, right? And they have all these recordings. I don't know whether you've watched The Staircase. Or things like that, where they have video recordings of what happens within the courtroom. And I'm sitting there thinking, how do they do this? It's quite remarkable. Imagine if that scenario was put into a Malaysian context. Imagine if cameras were allowed within, say, the Najib Razak court proceedings, right? So when Dato' Sri Najib Razak's trial begins...
And it should be televised.
Should it be televised? Should it be on social media? Should someone be live tweeting in the corner the way a stenographer takes down all the transcripts?
Definitely. I think the public will love that.
Absolutely.
But
I think
it's
coming
not
from
about
his
the public, though.
Yeah, correct. His point of view, though,
it's
if
about
you
a fair
are being.
Trial.
Yeah, he will say. Because already, remember when the trial first was announced, he was saying already he wanted a gag order on media, saying that it was trial by media. So I don't know whether if you have a video televised version of his trial, whether or not, you know, people might. The subject in question might say, oh, you know, I'm being trialed by
the public
opinion.
Well, you're the former prime minister, right? You appeal to the vote, to the electorate, based on a whole set of promises, and which have by and large been failed to materialise. You should be trialed by the public, right?
Ooh, all right. Well, tell us what you think. Do you agree with Mr. Kusu Chuang? Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got the 6:30 News Bulletin coming up with Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:41 right now. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Kusu Chuang and Joyce Goh. This morning, that was I Melt With You by Modern English. And speaking about English and all things language, we have the PKR President-elect Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim saying that Malaysians should uphold the national language, and this is to ensure the country's unity. That got us thinking to whether language is at the heart of a country's unity. What do you guys think?
Absolutely. You know, 25 years ago, I don't know how many years already, when I was back in the UK, right, and we went to... You know, when we wanted to speak among ourselves, you know, Malaysians, right? And then we didn't want the Masalis to understand. It was Bahasa. It was Malay. It was not Hokkien. It was not Mandarin. I mean, certainly in my case, I can't speak Mandarin, right? But it was Malay. Even among Chinese, it was Malay.
That is true. I go on holidays with my husband and we want to speak among ourselves and don't want the rest to know we'll speak Malay.
That is terrible. That is a bad example of how you use
of uniting.
Language.
But that's what it is. That's what binds us when we're abroad.
Okay, so help me get this right. So the idea is that one national language will unite us as a country. We already have a national language. Why is it not? I mean, you know, you could argue that it could do. We could do so much more in terms of national unity.
That's true. I think it's more than language for me. Language is one factor, but there are more factors when it comes to uniting
like
people. Like Malaysia, I think we unite over the love for food.
You're going to say that?
The love for public holidays. You know, but there are a lot more factors, like, I feel, than just national language.
Well, when I say about, so unity, right, in my mind means the lack of, so you know, you are colorblind, you don't see race, you don't see ethnicity, you don't see differences, you just see each other as another person. And the way to do that is, I guess, if you relate to that person through language, right? Because even if you bond over love for food, if you can't speak to each other, how do you do that? How do you bond over food?
Okay, so let's call a spade now. If you want unity in the country, then remove the institutionalized imbalances in the system. Let's call it racism. Okay.
Well, okay. That what do you mean institutionalized imbalances within the system?
Preferential access to funding, for example. Preferential access to universities, for example. Preferential.
Oh, so it's beyond just language.
Absolutely. If you want a country to feel together and all loved up, well, then remove all the structural impediments that are in the way, right? For example, access to housing, affordable housing, for example. You know, the privileges, right?
Okay.
If you want everybody to pay the same tax, education, then remove all those things. Remove the whole annotation of race and religion in your forms.
Yep, that's something we spoke about last week, you know, how to
remove all those things.
I guess, do away with all the race categories when it comes to filling up forms. Just have the Malaysian or non-Malaysian.
Exactly. Mm. In spite of all those imbalances, Malaysians are so loved up anyway. Imagine what it'd be like. It'd be a love fest.
It would be a love fest. But I also remember reading that one of the ways, so looking at other countries who have had one national language, like, say, Thailand, like, say, Indonesia, and you use language to foster people. So regardless of what ethnicity you are, you're talking to each other in one language. And I'm thinking to myself, we do that anyway, but whether we do that enough. And if that is, say, I guess putting forward one language, would that be to the detriment of, say, mastering English, which, you know, is language of business, or Mandarin, language of business in the future, for instance. So one over the other?
That's a secondary issue. I think, I mean, for example, in Singapore, you've got Mandarin and English cohabiting on equal parts and equal terms. But no, I think the larger issue, if you want national unity, is to remove every single impediment that is in place. And I know it's difficult to do so because of the historical and the legacy issues. But it's at least the recognition that if you want to have national unity moving forward, into the next 50 years of the country's history or existence, then we've got to be looking at these things.
We have Hiswani Hassan on Twitter saying that the best example of language uniting a country is Indonesia. Bahasa Melayu or Bahasa Indonesia is not the language that is spoken by the majority upon independence, but Sukarno chose to unite the country using the Malay language. And the majority of Indonesians actually speak Javanese. There you go. Mr. Tana as well, pointing to Indonesia and Thailand as examples of how language can unite a country. Tell us what you think. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. 6:46 right now. And after this, we're going to look at the question of whether 1MDB should be included in textbooks. Details next on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:50 right now. That was Rock and Robin by Michael Jackson. Hope that got you dancing in the car a little bit behind the wheel. Just something to pick you up in the morning. I'm Melissa Idris with Joyce Go and Kusu Chuang as we take a look at, the top stories of the day. Of course, coming back to our conversation a little bit earlier about language as a force of unity, we have Paul Lau on Twitter weighing in saying, Malay language is required for the middle class to communicate with the poor and rural Malaysians whose access to English education is limited. But we also have this WhatsApp from Anonymous, who says that my Malay language is good enough, my English is poor enough. I want to speak English more than Malay language. So I guess it depends on where you're coming from, right?
Yeah, definitely. We also have a tweet from Harakiri who says it's not enough when we asked the question whether is language enough to unite us. This tweet came in and said, yeah, not enough.
Okay, and we also have a message from Anonymous on WhatsApp saying that national unity starts from home and schools. So I think that's a very valid point. The other question we were looking at today is the issue of 1MDB and whether 1MDB should be included into textbooks, into school textbooks. So this is PKR veteran Dr. Syed Hussein Ali, who is a former UM lecturer, and he said that, you know, the scandal should be included in textbooks to teach children about anti-graft. What do you guys think?
Well, I think that, and there's been a few options available, and some of the listeners are saying, just make Billion Dollar Whale a textbook. Well, in that case, just make Clara Castle Brown's book and Gunnar's book a textbook, but that's obviously
recommended
going a bit
reading.
Too far, right? In school now, you've got things like moral studies, which by and large is ignored by parents because it's not seen as more as important as history or mathematics or science. Maybe there's a proposition for the whole 1MDB kleptocracy fiasco to be made to be inserted into the history books. Then it becomes a more serious subject rather
right.
than a moral subject.
Okay, so you're making the distinction of the subject matter, right? So the case itself should be included because it's part of our history and it's, I guess, a pivotal point in the history of our nation. So to include it in the history textbooks as opposed to perhaps anti-graft or ethics learning.
Ethics learning, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, true. Definitely a chapter, perhaps, there, history, because it's a turning point. But, you know, should it be on the scandal itself, the whole story, or should it be a bigger subject?
What kind of subject, Joyce?
When it comes to just anti-corruption, anti-graft, how it came about, what spurs people to do things like that, or to focus on that whole actual 1MDB story, the whole chain of events.
Dr. Amir Siddiq on Twitter says, no, don't waste time with 1MDB in textbooks in schools. Surely we have better things to learn. I'd love to hear what you think in terms of why you don't think this should be in I guess, the textbooks. I think there's only, you know, it's only a good thing, right? Learn from our mistakes. And why limit it to just 1MDB? I believe there's also a message on WhatsApp to say, well, there are loads of other things that we can learn from, you know, multiple scandals, Pawaja, Forex scandal, BMF, lopsided IPP contracts, all that to look and learn from. And why not, you know, look at what works and what hasn't worked within our public policy space?
Well, since we're going to throw the whole baby out with the bathwater, so let's just revamp the whole education sector and introduce things like, for example, financial literacy. You know, we go through 12 years of primary and secondary school without having to learn how to balance your personal pocket, right? And then you come out bright-eyed and bushy-tailed into the working world, and then you're landing yourself in debt because you just don't realise. So this whole financial literacy thing can also go hand in hand with the whole 1MDB scandal in terms of what's right and what's not, which way is up and which way is down. And then while we're at it, why don't we just also learn about interpersonal skills, dealing with one another, especially important in this day and age of social media.
Well, you've just expanded that conversation, haven't you? We went from 1MDB to interpersonal skills.
Well, it's a whole thing, isn't it? Right? If you want to come out with a well-rounded individual at the end of 12 years of school, plus another 3 years of undergraduate studies, 15 years, well, just do it all. Just transform the whole thing.
We have Sulip on WhatsApp saying, well, you know what else should be taught in schools? The Constitution. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. Tell us what you think. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got the 7 o'clock news bulletin coming up in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.